This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Mary Edwards, who, along with her husband, are personal survivors of a family suicide. And she talks about two out-of-the-darkness awareness walks that are going to happen, one in Chesterton, the other in Highland, to support the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. We'll also have a conversation that Michael Puente had with an Indianapolis immigration attorney about DACA. As well as we'll bring you the latest in the Indiana Humanities Quantum Leap STEM series, talking about Wolf Park. That and more coming up on Regionally Speaking, but first the news. This is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and residents in Northwest Indiana have two opportunities to show their support for the efforts to raise the funds needed for research into the causes into suicide. The first Out of the Darkness Walk is in Chesterton on September 16th, and then on September 20th at Wicker Park in Highland and Munster. Mary Edwards is helping organize the Lake County Walk, and I talked with her yesterday about the personal tragedy that suicide brings, as well as to her devotion to help others deal with it, and of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Well, AFSP, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, is a wonderful organization that is dedicated to increasing the understanding and preventing of suicide through their research, their education, and their advocacy. In order to do that, they need money to increase those efforts. And when almost 12 years ago, in fact, in October, it'll be 12 years, my husband and I received a phone call that we had lost our son to carbon monoxide poisoning. He was 19 years old. We just didn't feel like we had anywhere we could turn at the time. And the most important thing to us was to take care of ourselves. And then we started to realize that we had to do something to stop this. We had to stop it, especially for young people. And that seems to be our where we seem to be the most interested. And when I looked at just in their name, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, I was impressed, and I wanted to dig deeper in how we can really affect everyone around us by a better understanding and preventing of suicide. And the prevention is what I'm all about. And I jumped on the bandwagon just completely because I could see that there was a definite need. And the walks that the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention sponsors, like the one at Wicker Memorial Park, is their way of bringing us together, those who have lost somebody to suicide, where we can discuss and share our stories and also raise awareness and raise funds for their mission, the mission of AFSP, to decrease or increase the understanding and prevent suicide in the future.
Mary, tell us, if you will, about the experience, a sad experience that you and your husband had about your family members, and what kind of relationship mood disorders played in trying to deal with the tragedy, not only a personal tragedy, a family tragedy, but it's turned into, I guess, a national tragedy as well in dealing with suicide.
Well, you're definitely right. Suicide is the fourth leading cause of death for adults between the ages of 15 and 64 years in the United States. So there's definitely a problem here that we have to address. And a person dies from suicide every 12 minutes in the United States. And that's scary because when we lost our mark, it was at 16 minutes. And so it's not getting better. And AFSP is working really hard to change that. I believe their efforts are to reduce the amount of suicides by 20% by 2025, and that's really a big deal. If we can come close to that, just by increasing awareness and using our funds to bring out education and to increase education on it and research, the research is really important at this point.
Are we finding, and you've found too in your work, and in not only the organization but your own personal look into the problems that seem to be behind suicide? And we've talked here about, you know, educating people about mood disorders. It's not all, you know, the kind of mood that a person happens to be in that can prompt them to take their own life, but it certainly seems to play a rather large role, does it not?
You might be referring to is the fact that mental illness is a problem that we in the United States must learn to face and figure out how to help those people with mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
It's not any different than if you found out you were diabetic. And we have to find ways to make people feel, who are concerned about their own well-being as far as their mental health. They need to feel comfortable and to be able to go to a doctor and find help and assistance. And we don't have that at this time.
We're talking with Mary Edwards, who's a spokesperson on behalf of the upcoming Northwest Indiana Out of the Darkness Community Walk, which is going to happen on September 30th. It'll be from 10 o'clock in the morning till 1 in the afternoon at Wicker Memorial Park, which is, of course, located on Ridge Road and at Indianapolis Boulevard. It's in the community of Highland and Munster as well. The people that are involved in the walk are, I guess, of all basically walks of life, aren't they? It's not people necessarily who have necessarily lost someone to suicide, but people who have family members who have had contact with others that have had ones passing because of the suicide, because of suicide and just the other issues that come about here. I guess what I'm trying to find, do we find that there are many people that are involved in the walks, they need to tell people, they need to support the efforts to educate people about this very, very serious problem?
And absolutely. And of course, you know, just the word suicide is a word that we don't like to use very often. And even the idea that people are depressed and depression among the people. I mean, over 50% of all people who die by suicide suffer from some major depression. So I guess what it means to me is if these people knew they could turn to someone, and by bringing this to the forefront, the idea of suicide and mental illness at AFSP Walk, we're able to get these people to find help and realize that they shouldn't feel bad because we've had such a bad idea behind suicide. I mean, they just shouldn't be out there like that.
Now, if anybody's interested in participating in this year's walk that's going to happen at Wicker Park, how can they sign up and get registered for the event and what they should be sure to do when they come over on September 30th?
Okay, the easiest thing you can do is go to afsp.org, and in there you go to Community Walks, and you can sign up for our walk in Northwest Indiana at Wicker Memorial Park. And you're right, that is September 30th, but there's actually another one out in Chesterton, and it's September 17th.
Oh, great.
We like to share that. Yeah, we like to share that information because, to be honest with you, my husband and I would be at both because we just find discussing and telling our story with other people, it helps. It helps us, and it helps them. It brings hope to those that have recently been affected by suicide. So it helps both of us. And so we do both, but Northwest Indiana, if you go to afsp.org, you can sign up as an individual, you can sign up on a team, or to be honest, you can just come out and register that day. Same thing with Chesterton. I know that they would accept any walk-in registration as well. And look for us. My husband and I and any of the people that are working there, we are always willing to discuss and, again, tell our story because we do believe that that helps eliminate some of the bad feelings that we have. We'll have some speakers out there in Highland at Wicker Memorial Park, and I think that we can learn something from each other regarding this terrible thing that happened to our families and those that we love.
Once again, here on this National Suicide Prevention Month, which is the month of September, there are two Northwest Indiana Out of the Darkness walks, one coming up here on the 17th in Chesterton, and then another one on September 30th that'll happen at the Wicker Memorial Park in Highland and Munster. We've been talking with Mary Edwards, who has had family members, the loss of the family members because of suicide. She and her husband very much supportive of the national efforts to prevent suicide, and in turn of the American Foundation Coalition for Suicide Prevention, and I'm very much involved in both of the community walks coming up. Mary, thank you very much for spending time telling us about what you and your husband have felt and the ways that you deal with this loss in the family and to help other family members who are going through the same thing too and being involved in the community as well. Thanks for talking about the upcoming walks today with us.
You're very welcome, Chris. And remember, AFSP.org. Thank you.
The Trump administration announced on Tuesday it's phasing out the program known as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and he is leaving it up to Congress to come up with an alternative within 6 months. The program has provided nearly 800,000 young immigrants a reprieve from deportation, 10,000 of them here in Indiana. Indianapolis attorney Angela Adams works on immigration cases and DACA recipients, and Michael Puente spoke with Adams on Tuesday asking about her thoughts on Trump's actions to and about the program.
Very devastated. I've received many text messages. I've received Facebook messages, emails from former clients, some who may have an option and some who may not have any option. They're confused. They want to know what to do next. They want to know how to get involved in the conversation. I think there's a mixture of anger. I've seen some anger and I've seen some frustration, but I've also seen some hope. And I think that's one thing to remind folks about is that in the face of adversity, there's also an opportunity. And we can choose, you know, rightfully to be angry about a situation maybe that has this impact, this negative impact on folks. But hopefully keep in mind that this is really an opportunity for Congress to make some permanent changes to the immigration laws that hopefully would benefit the Dreamer population.
How do you see this in this move? Because a lot of people are talking about it in terms of, you know, some of the things Jeff Sessions was saying today just seemed like a slap in the face to immigrants.
I take issue with a lot of the Attorney General's comments, and I think if you sit down and you look at his remarks, you can really pick those apart. DACA kids are not criminals by the very nature of the DACA program. They have to pass that, you know, security clearance test, and they also cannot have certain criminal convictions, even minor criminal convictions. These are folks who are good kids. They're good students. They're not posing a threat to national security. They're not, you know, they're not taking anyone's jobs. In fact, you know, in Indiana, we have, like much of the country, a very low unemployment rate. And, you know, I hear every day from leaders in our community, from the restaurant and lodging association to the manufacturers to the agricultural industry that we have strong here in Indiana, how many jobs they cannot fill. Entry-level positions that they cannot fill. And so I think the argument, it's not a zero-sum game. You can't say that, you know, DACA kids are taking jobs from U.S. workers. That's not necessarily what's happening.
Michael Puente was speaking to Indianapolis immigration attorney Angela Adams. I-STEP scores from this past spring have stabilized after a major overhaul of the test caused results to plummet 2 years ago. And yet, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports that only about half of the students are still passing the statewide exam.
A little more than half of students in grades 3 to 8 passed both the English Language Arts and Math sections of the I-STEP in 2017. That's pretty much the same rate as last year. Average statewide scores dropped dramatically in 2015 after a new type of test was used. State officials have said it could take years for scores to return back to those high pass rates. Nearly 61% of students in grade 10 passed the math and English portions of the test. That's an increase of almost 2 points. The I-STEP has been criticized for its length, computer problems, and for how long it takes for results to be made available. A new test is supposed to fix that. The process for replacing the I-STEP with the so-called I-Learn exam is underway. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. On this week's episode, we are traveling to a place in Indiana that is home to the most curious thing, wolves. The small town of Battleground, with just more than 1,000 people, has wolves. Not wild wolves, of course. Wolves haven't naturally lived in Indiana since the early 1900s. No, in Battleground, there is a wolf park. The wolves are there on purpose, as part of one man's not-so-classic American dream. But why? To explain that, we have to go back a ways. Way, way back. Eric Klinghammer is the reason there are wolves in Battleground, Indiana. It was his unusual dream that brought the animals back to the Hoosier state. Eric was born in Germany in 1930 and lived there until the end of World War II, which ended soon after he finished high school. He immigrated to the U.S. to fulfill his lifelong dream of studying animals. And after serving in the U.S. Army for several years, he was rewarded by the GI Bill and went to college at the University of Chicago. He was obsessed with animals and longed to learn what different animal behavior meant. What did it mean when a parrot cocked his head to the side? And does it mean the same thing when a dog does it? He studied in the field of psychology and a subset that studies animal behavior called ethology. He received his PhD in 1962 in bird behavior, but unfortunately soon found out he was allergic, which was a big problem, because the way Eric interacted with the animals he kept was very particular. He needed to be able to live amongst the animals he studied. He soon met a fellow ethologist who was observing wolves, and he fell in love. So he stopped studying birds and started studying wolves. Two ethologists he knew from the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago gave Eric two wolves to take to the farm he owned in Battleground, Indiana. And that's where he began to achieve his very unusual dream of living amongst the animals he studied. While in Indiana, he also began teaching psychology at Purdue in 1968. In 1972, Eric brought his two wolves to his farm. Their names were Cassie and Coco. Imagine the dismay of all the farmers who owned farms next to Eric's. All of a sudden, they had wolves as neighbors to their chickens and cattle. But luckily, nothing bad happened because of the wolves. And in fact, Eric was about to do some incredible things that no Hoosiers could be upset about. After a few years of studying Coco and Cassie on his own farm, Hoosiers began to get curious about the wolves Eric was keeping and would drop by for visits. Eric realized he needed to open up his wolf park to visitors and have set visiting hours, or else he would never get any work done. So in 1976, he officially founded Wolf Park and opened it to visitors on weekends. He brought more wolves, additional team members, and lots of volunteers to help him study the behavior of wolves. And they eventually gathered so much data, they were able to make a wolf ethogram from it. What's an ethogram, you ask? An ethogram is like a dictionary, but for specific animals' behaviors. There are tons of ethograms out there that catalog different animal behaviors and actions. There are dolphin ethograms, anteater ethograms, even ethograms for crickets. Before Eric and his team at Wolf Park, no one had written a complete ethogram of wolves. But in 1990, after decades of studying wolves up close and personal, Eric Klinghammer and others published the world's largest and most complete wolf ethogram. To this day, there is nothing else like it. It's likely that anyone in the world studying or caring for wolves utilizes Wolf Park's ethogram to do it. Even after Eric's death in 2011, the wolf ethogram still is the largest and most complete to have ever existed, and remains a huge part of his legacy. But his legacy is much bigger than just this book. Wolf Park is still in Battleground, Indiana, and it is bigger than ever. It is a unique research facility where the spirit of Dr. Eric Klinghammer lives on. Staff there are even working on a new ethogram, one for foxes. They hope it will be the biggest and most complete fox ethogram by the time they are finished. And that's not all. Wolf Park encourages Hoosiers of all ages to hone their research skills. Most places only allow you to do research if you have a PhD, but not at Wolf Park. Even young kids can participate and try out research. On some days, children can go to Wolf Park and hide the wolves' food for the day so they can observe the foraging methods of the wolves. And teenagers can help with big research projects of Wolf Park, or pick small research projects to do on their own, like figuring out how to cut down the enormous amount of flies at Wolf Park. Exposing young people to scientific research is very unique. Kids rarely get the opportunity to do hands-on research, let alone with live wolves. It's amazing to be able to teach kids that they can do what scientists and researchers do, and that they can help solve the world's problems too. The unusual dream of Eric Klinghammer continues to be a great gift to Indiana and the world. Tune in next time for more stories of Hoosier dreams coming alive. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
New regulations for how big farms handle raw produce won't affect the hundreds of vendors that sell at Indiana farmers markets. But small-scale growers are still having to face plenty of rules to follow. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek has this look at how Hoosier farmers markets are able to keep their food safe to eat.
This is ground beef, and then like...
Graham Ryder digs through a freezer stuffed with plastic packages of frozen meat. His family owns Thistle Buyer Farm in Burnettsville, and he's in their trailer at the Lafayette Farmers Market.
Here's your thermometer. Oh, that's good. It's below 20.
That thermometer is one way his family keeps their food up to code at this market. They follow state rules, mostly common sense stuff, says Ryder, like basic labeling, keeping frozen foods cold enough, and washing and sorting raw produce. All that is enforced by the Tippecanoe County Health Department. Along with a full load of other restaurants and stores, they say they inspect each local farmer's market twice a season. Ryder says it's usually a surprise visit.
They just do, like, you know, the checklist of, like, things they're looking for. So, I mean, honestly, we probably get some demerits on dirty floor, but...
That little things like that, though.
Yeah, well, they'll, like, let's just go through, like, okay, so just general cleanliness and stuff like that.
Most Hoosier farms are like Thistle Buyer. They don't sell enough or over a large enough area to qualify for the strictest standards on things like raw produce. Purdue University food scientist Amanda Deering estimates only 60 or 70 farms out of about 2,000 in Indiana will have to comply with the latest version of those rules under the Food Safety Modernization Act.
So these are the growers who are shipping multi-state. They're growing, you know, a variety of different commodities. You know, it's our large cantaloupe growers, watermelon growers, and then others that are producing other fruits and vegetables.
In the next few years, she says, the big growers of anything meant to be eaten raw will have to meet new standards for training and storage, for how they use and test water and soil, and, here's the big one, for writing it all down.
I mean, a lot of it isn't new to them, especially the big guys that are going to be covered by the produce rule. But just keeping all these records, I think, is going to be one of the harder things.
And one of the costlier. Deering says that's why the new rule doesn't apply to small growers.
That's one thing that will never go away, is that people can always buy direct from the farmer. And the farmer's market is just a way to facilitate that direct-to-consumer sale.
How are you guys today?
Gary Cox runs Trinity Acres Farm in Darlington and sells produce at the Lafayette Market from May to October. The harvest of early August is spread across his table.
Swiss chard, eggplant, basil, green beans, zucchini, bell peppers.
He says he learned how to handle his produce properly through hearsay and can't remember ever being inspected. He says he's not even sure who makes the rules, but he knows what they are.
We go out and harvest, and then it's washed and packed within the hour, and then we refrigerate it, most of it.
Cox says that's the advantage for consumers at a farmer's market.
They're going to get it fresher. The less it's handled, the fresher it's going to be.
Nearby, Sharon Morphew carefully selects some of those fresh potatoes for a cookout tonight. She says she doesn't think much about how this produce was handled.
I wash them when I get home, so I'm not worried.
traditional farmers markets like Lafayette's probably won't face other regulatory changes soon. With the new federal rules in place for big growers, state reforms are focused on other kinds of agribusiness, namely wineries and breweries. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Lafayette.
On a recent Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon, the Lakeshore PBS host talked about populism and how politicians and citizens fit into the definition. Gerard McClendon brought into the studio Purdue University Northwest political science professor Richard Rupp and Kathleen Murphy of the Illinois Opportunity Project. Here's the conversation.
Populism, populist, what does it mean?
Well, it has a long history, actually. It is absolutely front and central to the political debate today, not just in the United States, but globally. And I think there are many definitions of populism. I think right at the outset, it's useful to note that populism really is not a political ideology. Populism is more of a strategy and a tactic of political communication. Mm-hmm. That might be a benign way of putting it. Another way of putting it is that populism is a strategy and tactic to acquire political power. And it can be of use to any of the political ideologies, liberalism, conservatism, libertarianism, socialism.
So it doesn't have, the idea of populism doesn't necessarily wear a party's uniform. It can kind of morph into what it needs to at that particular time for a party or for a candidate.
That's a good, very good way of putting it, because throughout history it has had peaks within the left and peaks within the right, and clearly now in the last few years we're seeing it peaking on the right, and we are seeing it as we've never seen it before in American politics.
Speaking of seeing it as we've never seen it before, Kathleen Murphy, in the last 18 to 24 months, how has populism peaked or morphed or changed? What have you seen in the last 2 years as it pertains to populism?
Well, I think we certainly saw the shock with Brexit. I mean, and that Britain voting to leave the EU, which I'm somewhat skeptical that that was entirely populist. Britain's always been a little bit ambivalent about Europe. They consider them sort of extra European, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
So I think there was some there was a feeling that they didn't want the sovereignty moved from Westminster to Brussels. So I think it was given more meaning because of the shock of it, but it was really just a return to the norm. For Britain. And then, of course, there was Trump's victory, which was a reaction to a political class in Washington that really had gotten out of touch with its voters, said one thing in the district, went back to Washington and did what they were going to do. They, you know, protected themselves from the impact of their own policies, ruled as if, you know, the American people were too stupid to figure this out. We saw it in the Republican primary. I came to it slowly. I mean, I fought Trump through Scott Walker, Carly Fiorina, Ted Cruz, of all people.
17
I fought
candidates.
It as long as I could. But then you have to ask yourself, why are we seeing this? And it's because people, for years, and I'm not just talking about the Obama administration, through Clinton, through Bush's, both 41 and 40, they have seen government grow larger and larger. They've seen the quality of their lives decline, and they know they want something different. They know that both parties have sort of abandoned them.
This is interesting because you never really in politics, of course, you're given basically an either or when it comes to candidacy, especially when it comes to the general elections.
Right.
But I want to come back to a point that you just made with Brexit and with the United States election. Professor Kathleen brings some reasons out, but was there a tipping point of sorts internationally of populism kind of rearing its head up saying, wait a minute, you know, we're not going to take this anymore? Is that where the voters went? Over the last, 2 years or so, internationally speaking, what do you say?
Well, the question goes to what explains the rise of populism at this time? and it has been underway for several years globally, and there are many reasons. One, it's interesting to think about populism within liberal democracies and populism within authoritarian states. And so, because it plays a role in both. And part of it is the strain on capitalism and Western democracy in the last, say, 15 years. You're seeing almost the calcified nature. Nature is too strong, but the calcification of the institutions, that it's recognized from a liberal perspective to a conservative perspective that the institutions of government, even the institutions of capitalism, the institutions of a market economy, are not functioning well. Mm-hmm. And so we can all see that. Mm-hmm. And this then spills down to income inequality, cost of living, that people are not being able to maintain their standards of living, mm-hmm. globalization, in which we see great deal of pressures, but then we also see other issues going on. And I would talk very much about the rise of advocacy journalism, particularly in the United States, and how that has now been picked up overseas. When we see the cable news networks, and that spills into a fueling of the populist message, which is demonization of the two sides.
Yes.
Is that one side is classically the populists are, we represent the good normal people, and the bad guys are those elites in Washington or Brussels or wherever they are.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No. So let me just ask you this within your answer. You mentioned authoritarian and democratic states. So is populism different in an authoritarian type of structure as opposed to a democracy, or is populism, does it have the same, to use an expression, does it have the same cousins in a democracy or in an authoritarian
state?
It's
similar, because one, it's the demonization of the opponent, and so that would be a core category. Very simple messaging. So you're reaching out to a base, and your base that you're reaching out to tends to be undereducated, tends to be disenfranchised, and so you're dismissing the media, you're demonizing the media, you are making sweeping statements about your opponents as being corrupt. You have both domestic enemies and foreign enemies. You're not particularly interested in compromise. There is a right and there is a wrong. You're in the right and they're in the wrong.
So it's very polarizing. Let's talk about this, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. The doctor mentions the undereducated. The doctor mentions polarization. Mm-hmm. Let me find out how to divide two forms of people, let me divide ethnicities. Let me divide, sexual orientation. Let me divide my political construct. Did you see this occur? In what ways did you see this occur in the United States last 2 years?
Well, I think there was divisive rhetoric on both sides of the aisle in this last election. At the end of the day, women voted for Trump. More minorities voted for Donald Trump than voted for Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. He did not a lot. The Republican Party needs to do a lot better about their minority outreach, but he still was able to appeal to a larger segment of it than Mitt Romney was. So, I agree, but I think that still, at the end of the day, you need to look at why this message is appealing to people, and it's because something resonates. There's something in their lives that they feel like is not being addressed by the ruling class. And if you look at Illinois, they would be absolutely right now. Mm-hmm. You look at Mike Madigan. Property taxes in Illinois, highest in the nation, twice the national average.
Oh,
in places
ridiculous.
Like Grays Lake, four times the national average. People are paying 48% of their home's value in property taxes, 35% of their home's value in property. It's like buying a house on a credit card. It's, people are being priced out of their homes in places like Cook County and across the state. But in South Cook County, we're seeing abandoned homes. You're renting your home from the government, essentially. Mike Madigan, the most powerful man in the state, is a property tax appeals lawyer. He controls every piece of legislation that comes to the floor in Illinois because of the way the rules are written. Mm-hmm. He's not interested in property tax reform. He's interested in keeping your property taxes high because he benefits from it. His law firm represents 7 of the 12 major buildings in Chicago.
Which should be a conflict of interest, but, you know, it's the Illinois way.
This is, and then he has Governor Rauner, who's come in and done a tepid job of opposing him. And I mean, he has prevented many things from being passed, but he hasn't really advanced the flag at
almost,
all.
Almost 3 years without a budget.
And meanwhile, this blame game goes on, and the people in the state are losing their homes. Meanwhile, they see they're mad at both parties. I mean, this is, and they are genuinely being hurt. People are losing their jobs. Businesses are leaving. People are genuinely being hurt in a way they've never hurt before. The ground is ripe in Illinois, I think, for a message from a candidate, which I haven't seen which one is going to do it yet, but any candidate who steps forward and says, listen, there's plenty of blame to go around. It is you and me against this Leviathan. I am on your side. That, and then do it. Run on property tax relief, and then do it. And then I think that message is the one that would work.
A one-word answer. Mm-hmm. Do we see the rise in populism when people are upset?
Absolutely.
Okay. Does populism go away when people are no longer upset, or does it still kind of exist?
It remains.
It remains, just on a more subtle level, possibly. Dr. Rupp, you mentioned that Republicans are pivotal with populism. Man, a lot of alliteration there. What do you mean by that? Republicans have been pivotal with their populism, or pivotal with their voice or platform.
Well, I've been arguing for the last year in looking at the United States that in a country that calls itself a liberal democracy, if it only has two political parties, it's imperative for both of those parties to be committed to the values of liberal democracy. And I believe I can objectively say in looking at the Republican Party, I'm very worried about the Republican Party because of what I see as a breakdown in its commitment to some of those core values. When I look at the party today, and I was a young Republican when I was a kid and worked for Reagan Bush in California, when I look at the party today, I don't see it articulating a political philosophy. The Democrats articulate liberalism and progressivism. I actually don't see Republican leaders in rank and file articulate a conservative policy.
So you feel that Republicans are Republican, capital R meaning generic, and not necessarily a Republican that's capital C or lowercase c conservative?
I think, unfortunately, the Republican Party has shifted to a energy that is so focused on holding power that is more important than advocating a conservative agenda.
You don't think the Democratic Party does that, though, either?
I think there's a difference.
I
think that the Democratic Party, with all of its flaws, mm-hmm. probably including nominating Hillary Clinton to be its standard bearer, is still a party that I can say articulates a political philosophy based on something I understand as liberalism and progressivism. Whereas when I look at the Republican Party, I don't see a coherent conservative uh-huh. agenda.
Kathleen, Republicans, pivotal? You agree, disagree?
Well, I mean, I agree in the point, to the extent that because they were concerned with, you know, they became part of the Washington establishment, did one thing in the district, did another in Washington, didn't get health care through, said they would, you know, budget reform would happen, didn't happen, they didn't repeal and replace Obamacare. They said these things would happen. They've worked weak and cowardly in Washington. Hence, we have Donald Trump as the nominee and eventual president. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you could say that the Democrat Party's principles were just as corrupted, that people felt that they weren't being served by the Democrat Party. Hence, Bernie Sanders' appeal on the left.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, and the Democrat Party sort of does violate its, you know, its principles that, you know, everyone should be treated fairly with, you know, superdelegates. I mean, right there. I mean, that election was definitely rigged against anyone other than Hillary Clinton.
It's frustrating that we have a candidate there may be one candidate that's extremely polarizing, but it's making a definitive point. Mm-hmm. There may be another candidate who isn't definitive, but the platform is so obtuse that you don't know what they stand
right.
for. And so I think that gives a populist candidate an opening.
Well, and Hillary Clinton moving her position wherever the poll tested, you know.
I'm talking to blacks today, so let me talk black.
Yes,
you know, hot sauce in her purse? Really? Hot sauce in her purse, you know.
Oh, I know, and that's just...
You know what, that's a whole other 30-minute show. Let me ask you two this. Is Republican synonymous with conservative in this country? It's not synonymous.
Nazi conservative, no. Conservatives, limited government. Mm-hmm. Republicans, I agree. A lot of Republicans have gotten away with that. There's a lot of big government in bed with big business Republicans. The George W. Bush was certainly one of them. Mike Huckabee is another. You know, there is the sort of protectionist. Mike Huckabee is a protectionist. Mm-hmm. A protectionist, meaning pro labor Republicans. Not all Republicans are conservatives.
It's not synonymous.
It's important
conservatives
to go back.
Are small government, limited government.
It's important
government.
To go back to note that populism knows homes in both camps and has a long history, probably even a longer history historically within more of the left, particularly in, say, Latin America. Mm-hmm. What's interesting today is that the populism today is primarily on the right in Europe and the United States. And there's a lot of...
Marie Le Pen is basically a socialist. I mean, she is a nationalist, which Trump is also a nationalist, but she is a socialist.
She's a socialist, but what makes her populist within that?
Well, it's the appeal to the common man.
Yeah.
That's all. It's not an ideology, really. It's just this appeal
to
the common
man. Which he mentioned at the beginning. It's funny, because I was reading the Cass Mudd article said, no definition of populism will fully describe all populists. Mm-hmm. That's because populism, and Dr. Rupp mentioned this earlier, is a thin ideology. Mm-hmm. Only speaks to a very small part of a political agenda.
And one thing that we haven't mentioned tonight is awfully important, is that populists, both left and right, tend to demonize elites, but also demonize intellectualism, experts, bureaucrats. There's a sense that if only normal people were making decisions about property taxes, if only normal people were making decisions about public policy, all would be well.
This is
a pretty common tactic of populist. Both overseas and here at home.
That demonization is only effective because people can believe it. I mean, we have so many people now because of a liberal agenda that are beyond reproach. You cannot criticize, certain groups of people. You can't criticize ideas. You can't say, so I think that people feel like they believe that there is this protectionist, there is this insular class that's protecting itself against, all these...
Populism works because elites are failing to do their job.
Yeah.
Republicans and Democrats are failing to do their job. And the masses are quite ignorant.
Yeah.
And elites who choose to be populist...
But elitist statement.
Elites, not necessarily.
Elites who choose to be... This is actually the literature in the field. Elites who actually use populism know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly that the masses are not particularly well-versed, not particularly well-educated. They don't want complicated arguments that require them to watch shows like this.
Okay.
Because I can assure you, Gerard, that the voter who you want to be watching this program tonight is not watching this tonight.
You don't think so?
No.
Are voter sheep? Are voters primarily illiterate people who believe in what? Do they believe in what kind of scratches their ear as opposed to something that may be an empirical fact?
The American political system political system let the people down this past year. That our political system, our establishment is dysfunctional, and the people are going to the barricades on the right and left, which is such an interesting phenomena that it was both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So that was a major statement.
Donald Trump won in the same place as President Obama won. Donald Trump won more Obama... He did. He won in Obama's electorates. So he won a lot of those.
Were the United States candidates, and I'll say, I'm going to say all the candidates, not just the candidates in the general, but were all the United States candidates in the general and the primary for running for president, was that the best that the United States had to offer? Now, I know that's a loaded statement, but really, was that the best? Ben Carson, really? Bernie Sanders, Trump.
Well, yeah, really? I'll speak on
that. Ted Cruz, really? I mean, Hillary Clinton, was that the best we had to offer?
You know, it's who's in office, who's... I thought that the Republican field was actually a very good Republican field. It's just the fact, for the past 8 years, Republicans had broken their promises repeatedly, over and over and over again. I thought Carly Fiorina was a qualified candidate. A Rex Tillerson would have maybe been a better candidate than her because he had
big oil.
A lot of experience that, you know, President Trump didn't have, so, at that point. But, it's a good question, and it's tough to answer.
It was almost insulting.
But it's who we had.
Yeah, and that's...
But the system is part of that, that creates that. For example, the U.S. Supreme Court, fortunately, is going to hear a major case on gerrymandering. Mm. And there is no question that part of the banal conversation that we have in this country regarding politics is because our legislative districts are so tightly woven for either Republicans or Democrats, mm-hmm. we don't have a conversation going. That is to say, you're not bringing in a group of people living in the greater Northwest Indiana mm-hmm. Crafted into logical geographic districts.
That's true.
And so that Republicans and Democrats, people of a variety of perspectives, are in the same room with Pete Vasklosky or mm-hmm. whoever else is the congressperson, and they're having a conversation. Where we are now, we were getting so polarized because mm-hmm. our political class, and it's Republicans and Democrats, both of them totally culpable for this, have created these districts that are uncontestable. The other component, of course, is money. Mm-hmm. And until we have a conversation or until we take action, and frankly, open up the First Amendment and consider amending the First Amendment, we will continue to have the role of money. If you look at the role of money in the last election, it was defining. It was defining to a point. It became less defining when Donald Trump became less defining because, I mean, Governor Bush raised a ridiculous amount of money, maybe $50 million, and did nothing with it. But still, they can control the early part of the debate. Mm-hmm. But no, you're absolutely right. Trump's message came in, the entertainment quality, the show that he is incredibly talented at producing, and so money did not become terribly important. And again, if you ask political scientists at the end of the day, did money decide the election? Hillary Clinton was spending just as much or less. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And Trump commanded the news cycle with tweets,
right.
and his presence became the story.
Right. Well, and I think, and this is just a good example of how insulated the political class really is, and there is a political class, and the media, frankly, was that they couldn't see what he saw. He heard a voice that no one else heard, and he read the electorate better than anyone else. That map was not at all what anyone expected. You saw the faces on CNN and MSNBC on election night. None of them could see it happening.
Yeah.
That's because the bubble.
Pennsylvania, Wisconsin.
Correct.
You know, Hillary Clinton doesn't go back
Hillary
to...
Hillary Clinton goes and says, can't believe... I mean, you need Pennsylvania, major state. You don't go and say you're going to put coal miners out of business and make that... You know, that was... Death Valley goes in there.
Wow.
Trump
so you're saying that sometimes we can't...
wins Pennsylvania and everyone's awestruck.
So sometimes we can't tell voters the truth.
I would not say that Donald Trump listened to his voters. What Donald Trump did very effectively is activate a latent authoritarianism that is within a sadly large percentage of the American electorate.
And was that attractive?
What was authoritarian?
Was that attractive
what
to
was
some voters to say,
Well, we have pretty solid data on what voters believe. Mm-hmm. And so as far as their views on race, as far as their views on diversity, minority rights, civil rights, we have very solid information about this. And we can see that what transpired in the election is that these Americans, and this is a global phenomenon, of course, voters around the world have authoritarian perspectives. They're not active authoritarians in the United States. These are not people, you know, getting ready to seize the moment.
That is Purdue University Northwest political science professor Richard Rupp, along with Kathleen Murphy of the Illinois Opportunity Project, with host Gerard McClendon. Counterpoint, by the way, is Friday nights at 8 on Lakeshore Public Television, rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And tomorrow, of course, is Reporters Roundtable Thursday. It's when we bring in the local media to talk about the major stories of the week. We hope you can join us for that.